Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The theme of the broadcast today is relatively simple, gang. It really is a global economy. Just ask Japan or Asif Manvi. We did. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, the 17th of November. Great, as always, to have you here, gang. From time to time on this particular radio program, we warn you not to put too much emphasis on any single number. And that is generally, if I may say, pretty good advice. Today, however, there is such a single number that's been getting a whole lot of emphasis. It comes from Tokyo, and it is -1.6%, the amount by which the Japanese economy shrank in the third quarter, contrary to near universal expectations of modest growth over there. And it has everybody using the R word in reference to Japan again, a recession in the world's third largest economy. Bad news this big has many causes, of course, but here is one key takeaway as we see it. Tax policy really, really matters. Stan Alcorn explains now from New York.
The Japanese economy has been sick for decades. It's got two main symptoms: stagnant economic growth and ballooning government debt. The doctors in the government have focused primarily on growth, but recently pivoted to focus on debt as well. David Stockton at the Peterson Institute says that shift in treatment has made Japan's growth malaise worse.
Maybe in this case, the dosage was just too hard for the patient, and the patient is relapsed now.
The dosage in this case was a sales tax increase from 5 to 8%.
Sales taxes are typically on goods.
Liz Malm at the Tax Foundation.
You've got the classic law of demand kicking in here, where if the price of a good goes up, you tend to get less consumption of a good.
In Japan's case, those goods included durable, big-ticket items like homes. Josh Hausman is an economist at the University of Michigan.
If you're buying eggs every week, you're not going to stockpile eggs because they're going to go bad. But if you're going to buy a house, then you might think about buying a house 6 months sooner than you otherwise would have.
Hausman says the Japanese did a lot of spending before the price increase kicked in and then cut way back. That provided some GDP relief before the April tax hike, but a relapse afterwards that we saw in the new numbers.
I think this sort of adds to a growing body of evidence that contractionary fiscal policy, so raising taxes or cutting spending, can be quite damaging, more damaging than many economists might have expected.
Abe is now expected to delay a second dose of sales tax increases scheduled for October. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
The temptation, of course, when one hears a story about bad economic tidings from far away is to say, whew, glad that's not us. Herewith, then, an observation from the University of Hawaii economist Sumner LaCroix.
Japan is the fourth biggest trader in the world, and we still trade extensively to Japan. We export agricultural goods to Japan, beef, pork. There's also airplanes from Boeing that we export to Japan. And if Japan is doing poorly, that's not going to help us.
Best looking horse in the glue factory, I think I've described us as. But anyway, from the good people who track energy production in this country came this news this morning. We were pumping more than 8.5 million barrels of oil a day this past summer. We haven't seen those kinds of numbers since President Reagan's second term. As you know, all that production has pushed gas prices way down, but it is not all good news. Just ask the budget managers for a state like Louisiana. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has that story.
Petro-states like North Dakota and Louisiana like high oil prices. That's because their oil taxes are tied to oil's market value. Unfortunately, Louisiana budget planners were counting on prices to stay high, like $95 a barrel kind of high. Greg Albrecht, chief economist in the state's legislative fiscal office, says this past spring that didn't seem like such a bad forecast.
I mean, prices were bouncing around $100 a barrel. And in fact, for a couple of months into this fiscal year, we had $100 plus a barrel of oil prices.
Now, Louisiana figures it'll get $90 million less in oil and gas taxes than planned. And how will the state make it up? Probably through cuts to health care and higher education, says Jeremy Alford, publisher of a Louisiana Politics website.
So a lot of officials on the university level are bracing for serious cuts in next year's budget.
In North Dakota last year, oil and gas taxes made up over half of all state revenue. But Pam Sharp, director of the state's Office of Management and Budget, isn't predicting disaster. State law there requires most of that money go into various reserve funds, not the general fund.
The way the oil taxes are structured in North Dakota, and I think it puts us in a really good shape to weather that kind of storm.
Falling oil prices do mean less money for roads and school construction loans, Sharp says. But in this two-year budget cycle alone, she expects North Dakota will collect $6 billion in oil and gas taxes. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, two up, one down. You guys get to guess which is which. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. High on the list of iconic American companies is a firm that back in the day was called Firestone Tire and Rubber. Firestone's history, both distant and recent, is the subject of a joint ProPublica Frontline documentary that airs tomorrow night on PBS. It's called Firestone and the Warlord. It's a story that begins in 1926 when Mr. Firestone himself made a deal with the government of Liberia, 1 million acres of rubber tree plants at 6 cents an acre. It is a deal that 60 years on, by the late 1980s, would become much, much more complicated. ProPublica's T. Christian Miller is one of the reporters behind that film. T., it's good to have you with us.
I'm glad I can be here.
There are 60 years, plus or minus, between the establishment of this plantation and the events of this film and of your stories. But and we're going to skip ahead, but I want you to tell me what Firestone came to mean to the Liberian economy in those 60 years. How important did it grow to be?
So Firestone dominated the Liberian economy. They were the largest employer. They were the largest taxpayer. They built a lot of the country's roads. They introduced currency. Firestone took the idea of a company town and turned it into a company metropolis.
Right.
It was a huge, sprawling plantation. It took up 10% of Liberia's arable land. So from very early on, Firestone and Liberia were married together in a very fundamental way.
And then late 80s, early 90s, a series of coups and government overthrows devolves into a civil war, and a guy by the name of Charles Taylor winds up controlling this plantation. Remind everybody who Charles Taylor was in the history of Liberia and this company.
So Charles Taylor was a guerrilla leader, educated in America, who started the civil war in Liberia. And just as kind of a signal of how bad this war was, Charles Taylor became the first person since Nazi Germany as a head of state to be convicted of crimes against humanity.
He winds up controlling the plantation. What does that mean for the American expats and the Firestone employees who were on this plantation, and also the, 8,000 Liberians who are working there?
Yeah, this is where it really gets interesting, where this becomes a story about choices, the choices that a big American corporation faces when it comes into contact with a violent guerrilla leader, which happens all the time. Firestone, which has been this dominant company for many years, became the front lines of the Liberian Civil War. People were killed, civilians were killed. Some of the Firestone managers had RPGs pointed at their chest. So after a period of about 10 days, Firestone realized that they couldn't stay there any longer. It was just too dangerous for their expatriates. And so they flew their expatriate staff back home, while the Liberian staff, there was 8,000 workers, were left in Liberia.
And then they come back. That, to me, was the nut graph of this whole thing. Firestone says, you know what? We got to come back.
Yeah, that was the nut graph for me as well. A lot of the Firestone executives, as well as Liberians, will tell you that the decision to come back was this turning point for Firestone as a company. They could have remained out of the conflict. They weighed all the decisions, and they decided that they should return and try and build their rubber plantation again. Firestone will tell you they were very concerned about their employees And let's face it, as the Firestone folks told us, it's a business, and they have a responsibility to make a profit. I would say there's a final thing that several Firestone folks told us, which is that there was this emotional attachment as well. They had a long history with Liberia. Liberia had a long history with them. These are people who had known each other for years, who'd grown up together. They just didn't want to walk away from that.
Did Firestone cut a deal with Charles Taylor to be allowed back into that country and to make this plantation work again?
So what we know from our documents is that Firestone signed an agreement with Charles Taylor's rebel government. That agreement said Firestone would pay taxes to Charles Taylor's government and that Charles Taylor's rebel forces would provide the plantation protection.
And so to the question that you guys ask at the end of the film, does Firestone then have blood on its hands after all this?
So it depends very much on your perspective. Certainly, we had American diplomats, Liberians, who believed that, Firestone was complicit in Charles Taylor's civil war. Firestone, of course, would deny that. They were not there to help Charles Taylor fight a war. They were there to run their business. And as part of having to run their business, they had to pay taxes to the guy who was in charge. At that time, Charles Taylor was in charge.
T. Christian Miller is a senior reporter at ProPublica. The film that ProPublica and Frontline did together that airs tomorrow night on PBS is called Firestone and the Warlord. T., thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Coming up.
Then, of course, they said to me, do you actually know how to snake charm?
Asif Manvi on bad auditions and a whole lot more. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials ended up 13 points, just shy of a tenth of 1% today, 17,647. The NASDAQ off 17 points, about a third percent, closed at 4671. The S&P 500 up a single point less, obviously, than a tenth percent, 2041. Halliburton's $34 billion buyout of its oilfield services competitor Baker Hughes was confirmed today, and thus Baker Hughes climbed nearly 9%. Halliburton slid 10%. Don't read too much into that. That always happens. Bank of America dropped 0.2% on news the Supreme Court has agreed to hear appeals in two mortgage cases against the bank. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.33%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues the October Producer Price Index. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. And are consumers making home improvements? Home Depot releases quarterly earnings. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. To your list of demographic cohorts, which already includes the baby boomers and Generation X and Gen Y, also known as the millennials, it is perhaps time to add Generation Z, kids born in about the mid-1990s and on, kids who are just now starting to hit college campuses. They've never really known a world without Google or without smartphones. They came of age in the Great Recession. They are entrepreneurial, socially conscious, and more than a little bit concerned about college. We've teamed up with Northeastern University to do a survey, more than 1,000 16- to 19-year-olds, on everything from their worldviews to how they expect to pay for school. And then we sent Marketplace's Amy Scott to a high school outside Washington, D.C. to meet Generation Z. Here you go.
College application season is in full swing at Bethesda Chevy Chase High School. Students pour into the office of College Tracks. It's a program that helps low and moderate income students navigate the process.
So this is just a little bit of background information about what we do, colleges that students have gone to, and you can show that to them just as a reminder.
The office is packed because this generation of high school students has heard over and over again from their parents, their teachers, their president, that college is a must.
Because nowadays you need a degree to get a good job.
It's kind of something that everyone does now.
That's the extra step we need to fulfilling what we want to be when we're older.
That's Daniel Roa, Alexandra Holler, and Adam Mangani, all seniors at Bethesda Chevy Chase. They're part of the first wave of Generation Z. If you haven't even heard of Gen Z, don't worry. Neither had they.
No, oh, I have no idea what that means.
Explain.
Please.
Gen Z, or the I generation, as some have called it, refers to people born roughly since the mid-90s. Our survey looked at 16 to 19-year-olds. About two-thirds of them plan to attend at least some college right out of high school. And two-thirds said they were concerned about being able to pay for it. When I bring up loans, the students I'm talking to recoil.
I don't want any loans.
Last resort.
It's not worth the debt. It's not worth it.
It's no wonder they're down on debt. The first wave of Gen Z watched their parents struggle through the recession. They saw older brothers and sisters graduate and not be able to get jobs. Tamara King, 17, with long hair and braces, says the warnings are everywhere.
Didn't the president just finish, like, paying off his debt, like, a year ago?
Actually, it was, like, 10 years ago, but still.
I mean, it paid off. Easy. I mean, he's the president. It paid off, so in the end, it was a good result. So, but I wouldn't want that.
So where will the money come from? Almost a quarter of the students we surveyed said mainly from their parents. More than a third expect grants and academic scholarships to foot most of the bill. Heather O'Leary studies Gen Z as an analyst with the higher ed research firm EduVentures. She says that may be wishful thinking.
Our research also has shown that students are expecting an inordinate amount of merit-based and need-based scholarships, even students whose families are coming from very high income levels.
O'Leary says colleges are partly to blame for the false expectations because they set high tuition prices, then compete for students by offering them discounts in the form of financial aid.
And it also, you know, falls to parents who have been telling them, you know, from a very early age, they're all very special snowflakes and they should be recognized for that individuality.
The individuals I talk to don't expect college to come easy. They plan to work or save money by starting at community college. What they do expect, just like most of the kids who took the survey, is for college to prepare them for careers by offering courses in entrepreneurship and building in practical experience through things like internships. Tiffany King, Tamara's twin sister, plans to do as many internships as possible.
Even if you graduate and you wave around, hey, I got my college degree, where's your experience in that field? Do you have a reference, anything?
Despite their worries, this is an optimistic bunch. Almost two-thirds expect to be better off financially than their parents. Adam Mangani, the son of Somali immigrants who didn't go to college, says his generation has time.
Our economy will change after we graduate college. So just keep, like, your head high and your hopes up that you can get a job.
Not that these kids have the luxury of worrying much about life after college. With application deadlines looming in the next few months, right now they're just anxious about getting in. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Put yourself in their shoes for a minute. The kids, I mean. Take our quiz to see if you can think like a Gen Zer. It's on our website, marketplace.org. If and or when you flip on television news today, you're likely to see a way more diverse set of people on screen than you used to. Same is true even on satirical news programs like The Daily Show, which if you've ever watched, and if you haven't, then why not? But if you have, they have fittingly satirical job descriptions for their reporters, the senior black correspondent, for instance, or in the case of this next interview, senior Muslim correspondent. Just how Asif Manvi got that job is a longer story that he tells in his new book, No Land's Man. Asif, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
I'll tell you what, man, this book is by turns hysterical.
Thank you.
Don't get ahead of yourself because it's also parts of it. Parts of it are also.
But not only is it.
That's right. It's sad and hard to read, and it's parts of it are not a lot of fun because there's racism and there's all kinds of stuff in here.
Tough
book to write.
It was very cathartic to write, you know. It was, these are the themes I was attempting to explore, often through humor and sometimes not.
Yeah. The device, we should say, is I guess you could call it a journey home, right? You go back to Bradford, England, and we should give the biographical sketch here, right? Born in Bombay, then Bradford, and then Florida when you're 16, right?
Yeah.
Not to give it away, but you go back to find that theater that arguably launched you on your career as an actor, and it's not there, man. It's an open field.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I went back to the place. There's this little children's theater where I first discovered my bug and penchant and proclivity for performing and acting. And I went back after all these years, and the place had burnt down. The book, you know, is called No Land's Man, and I keep searching for a home and ultimately realize that the metaphor of the open field is really the home that I've been searching for, you know.
How much did that journey that you took in this book, or I guess the start of it, affect your choice of career and you finding work as an actor now, as an adult?
I never know whether the chicken or the egg came first. You know, as an immigrant, I think one of the things that always happens to you is you find out how to adapt to the new environment and to how to adapt to the predominant culture. And so that adaptation created a lot of versions of myself, you know. Some of them, you know, is a false self, but it is still something that I think allows you to then perform and be. And then, you know, the journey is also going back and trying to integrate that with an authentic self that you try to find in your life through therapy or this
or
craft
performance,
called
right?
acting
yeah.
or performing. Yeah.
Well, so let's talk about that authentic self for a minute. You make your way to New York, you find yourself an agent, and you go out on your first national television commercial audition.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me that story, because that's all racial identity and sense of self and the whole deal.
Right. I'd been in school and I'd been doing all this stuff, and then I came to New York and it was the professional world, and I went on this audition for some commercial and they wanted me to be a snake charmer. I went in and tried to do this Indian accent and this head wobble that they kept asking me to do. I had suppressed it so far inside of myself that I couldn't do it. Like, I couldn't do the Indian accent, because the Indian accent to me was associative of my father and that immigrant sort of image that I didn't want to be. I couldn't do it, and I ended up doing this weird, bad, like, sort of, it sort of ended up sounding like a Russian or an effeminate Arab or something, you know. And of course the director was kind of like, that's great, terrific, and I suddenly was like, no, it's terrible. Why would you possibly think that was a good Indian accent, and why do you not care that it's not a good Indian accent, you know? And then of course they said to me, do you actually know how to snake charm? But I didn't get the job. And they gave it to a very swarthy-looking white guy.
A white guy, right. And I mean, you see this ad later and you're like, come on, man.
Right. And, you know, and in the story I talk about the sort of internal conflict that I go through of, like, should I do this? More and more of those auditions came along, and eventually you have to pay the rent and you have to, like, feed yourself. And so you start doing that stuff and then kind of start to get immune to what it is. And that's finally me getting to writing my one-man show.
When you wrote that one-man show, and it took years, and it was a workshop, and you had, you know, acting lessons and all that stuff, you get it on, and it does well, and the New York Times, you say, is very generous in its review. It's called Sakina's Restaurant, by the way, we should say, just to give it the plug. Was that the exorcising of the demon for you, or is it still around now?
You know, it's something that I think I will always deal with. And now it is my, you know, that constant question of what is it to be South Asian American, what is it to be a South Asian American man? That question is constantly in my work and will continue to be, and actually becomes my source of power now, you know. But when I wrote Sakina's Restaurant, it was really about, I just wanted to write characters who were human beings and not cartoons from my ethnic background and from my experience. So it got me in touch with my own cultural identity in a way that I never imagined. I was writing it for non-South Asians. Mm-hmm. And then what happened was, as word got out about the play, people started coming, and Indians and Pakistanis and Muslims and Arabs and Greeks. And these people, especially the South Asian people, had never seen themselves reflected on stage before.
And then one day, The Daily Show calls, and you said, in essence, sorry, I'm not in the mood, I'm busy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You know, they called, and I remember my manager called, and the first thing they said was, The Daily Show is looking for a Middle Eastern type. And I thought, well, this is the most elaborate Homeland Security sting operation I've ever heard of. This is not going to go well. And I also had done this kind of thing before. I'd gone on Letterman and been like the voice of Saddam Hussein or Jimmy Kimmel and been a tech support guy. And so I thought it was going to be one of these things where I was going to end up like putting on a turban and sitting on a carpet and pretending to fly or something, you know? So I said, no, I don't want to do it. They called back and they said they're actually looking for a correspondent. And I said, okay, fine, I'll go down there. And I really didn't know what I was doing. And you know, and I did what basically all the Daily Show correspondents do, which is I just did my best Stephen Colbert impression. you know, I went down there, I put on a suit and tie, I arched one eyebrow and got the job. And got the job not only in that moment I got the job.
Right.
And it was on, and I was on the show that night.
Does it bug you that many, many millions of people only know you as Asif Manvi, the guy on The Daily Show, as opposed to the guy who has done substantive theatrical work on a whole lot of difficult issues?
You know, it doesn't bug me. It's interesting when people realize, you know, when John hired me, he specifically wanted someone who was an actor and not a quote-unquote comedian, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he got. And I don't think of myself as a comedian. I think of myself as an actor who does comedy. And even on The Daily Show, I feel like that person that I play is a character who happens to have my name. But he also has a team of very funny Ivy League educated Jewish comedy writers that go around with him wherever he goes.
It is a book called No Land's Man by Asif Manvi. You've seen him on The Daily Show and a bunch of other places. Asif, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of what could possibly go wrong. Snapchat, the smartphone app that lets you send pictures or videos to somebody else that disappear after a couple of seconds, is now getting into the mobile payment business. It's a peer-to-peer payment thing. It'll be called Snap Cash. You can use it to send money to your friends. Just as the company says in its announcement, after you enter your bank account information, type in a dollar amount and hit the green button. So you guys do that. Let me know how that goes, all right? All right, we're done. You can hear the music. That means we got to hit it. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Daisy Palacios, and Gina Delvac. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. You can send me your cash. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.